From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Some tales are as old as time.
True as it can be.
Today, not everyone's happy with the remake of Disney's Beauty and the Beast. We'll talk about that in the break room, and whether the state should encourage coyote hunting, and whether Pope Francis should encourage married men to become priests. But first, we talked last week about a new Prohibition Museum that's opening up in Savannah. Museum manager Kayla Black talked about why this museum needs to be in Savannah.
They called this the spigot of the South in the 1920s because huge amounts of liquor from the Caribbean was coming up through here and then being distributed throughout the Midwest. We were the funnel of alcohol.
Here are your first thoughts. Listener Free Palazzo reached out on Facebook and he says, quote, I wonder if the museum links the end of Prohibition with the beginning of the attack on drugs like pot and heroin. I heard that another enemy was needed to be identified before alcohol could be embraced. Is that fact or is that fake history? And that is something we're going to have to check with the Prohibition Museum to find out. But we always want to get your questions and your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or post on Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The FBI is investigating an alleged breach of voter data at Kennesaw State University. State officials learned earlier this month that more than 7 million voter records from the KSU Center for Election Systems may have been compromised. The university said in a statement it is, quote, working with federal law enforcement officials to determine whether and to what extent a data breach may have occurred involving records maintained by the Center for Election Systems, end quote. With me to explain is Christina Torres. She's a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Always good to see you, Christina.
Happy Friday. Good morning.
So what records are we talking about? Because the state, the Secretary of State's office says this did not involve records they oversee. So what are these records?
So the center has a very unique relationship with the Secretary of State's office. They're on contract with them. The state is its only client. So they build every ballot you use in an election. They help maintain every machine used in an election in Georgia. They build every, what they call e-poll books, sort of the electronic poll book a precinct worker will check you in on. It's a very specific and very, the work they do is just very particular. What they will do is download the data from the Secretary of State's database. So voters in Georgia who are registered need to be on a poll book. It's that data we think they may be looking at.
But they have also said that the university doesn't maintain a live database or a voter registration database.
Correct. But they are downloading the information to upload it onto these poll books to get the poll books out to the precincts. So it's not a live. There's an air gap there, what they call an air gap. It's not directly on the internet. It's not something you access. They access directly on the internet. But it gets downloaded to their database so they can get it on these poll books. It appears, and we don't know for sure. I need to stress that there's unknowns.
Yeah, the FBI has told us almost nothing.
FBI has told us nothing. U.S. Attorney's Office has said the investigation's ongoing. They otherwise don't have a comment. We don't know anything else from the Secretary of State's office or from the university. They're referring questions to the federal agencies.
Who are not answering those questions.
Well, it's hopefully soon. We do have a special election coming up April 18th, and I certainly think everyone wants to get this cleared up or have some sort of answers before then. They have that data. We think that's what they're looking at. We think somehow I think there's a fear that there may have been some malware or something that may have somehow gotten into their system and then sort of bypassed that air gap and gotten in. It could have been a phishing email. We just don't know. But the records, because there was specific reference by sources to voter records, the records they have are those I just discussed. So that's why we think it's centered on that.
And the other thing we should mention is that we also don't know who may have hacked it. In other words, and how they may have used it. So at this point, it doesn't look like there's any evidence people stole identities for use of getting money.
We just don't know.
Yeah.
So there again, the possibilities may be a white hat hacker, someone who wanted just to test the security and then reached out and said, hey, I was able to do X. You need to check on that. It could have been something with a much more malicious intent.
I want to go back for just a second. You may have lost people when you said it could be a white hat.
A white hat hacker, and I'm sure I'll muddle this up a little bit. It's someone who is with no ill intent testing a system to say, hey, you have a vulnerability there. You need to fix it.
Right. But and a black hat person is
bad.
You know, yeah, they're bad.
Quote, bad.
Exactly. Okay. So this has all become a point of contention, as you say, because a special election is coming up. But it also has sort of fed into a broader discussion about the security of election systems in Georgia. How is this fitting into that broader conversation?
So I need to be clear, going into now, Georgia has successfully run elections, of course. We just did the presidential election. There's no evidence there was any problem, but it feeds into this fear that candidates last year had brought up of, our elections may be tainted because someone may be able to influence them by getting into the system, changing results, or something like that, that there may be a hacking or illegitimacy. Which I know experts fear because they don't want to illegitimize the results, right? We have a democracy. You cast your ballot. You need to trust your ballot has been cast right, that is properly recorded, and that it counted. There's no evidence of any problems in Georgia, but it feeds into a fear, I think, that is out there and that got brought up in last year's presidential election.
And one reason that it got brought up is because the software used in our election machines our voting machines is very, very old. And the federal government offered help with cybersecurity over the voting machines. And Georgia was one of the few states that turned that down. So what else have we heard from the Secretary of State about the security of voting systems? And have we heard anything from Brian Kemp about this particular hack that the FBI is investigating?
I think the Secretary of State is being very cautious, no small part because this is an investigation run by federal officials. And I think they've made clear that they're in charge and they want everyone to follow that. He has expressed confidence that they will find the perpetrator, assuming that there may have been a malicious intent here. You know, again, they're stressing that there's no evidence, there's no problem with elections. Things have run smoothly up until then, and they're just making sure that things continue to run smoothly. Now, getting into the idea of the machines, Georgia's DREs, direct recording electronic machines, the voting machines, you recognize as a voter by touch screen. You go up, you press the touch screen and vote. They're old. There's no question. They were essentially new in 2002. You know, we're in 2017. I think there's a question of whether this should prompt a policy discussion of updating the system Georgia uses to vote with, because there is more modern technology out there. There are other states that use more modern technology. Voting experts, and I'm talking about nonpartisan folks who just follow the technology of this and the security of this, highly recommend some sort of paper audit trail. Mm-hmm. That, you know, maybe it's you fill in a bubble and so that you have something you can go back to and verify that's what you meant to do.
Right, which would be the opposite of new technology. That would be going back to
analog
technology.
It's ironic because we're talking about paper and filling in a bubble. But, you know, and there's some electronics there because they have to feed it in. The machine reads it and it's more, you know, it's quicker than counting just strictly a paper ballot. You know, Georgia does not have a paper audit trail. And so that's part of this discussion of whether there should be a policy, you know, conversation among the governor, among the Secretary of State's office, among lawmakers, because it will cost tens of millions
backup,
of dollars.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not simply a Secretary of State deciding, oh, we can do this. Georgia, by law, has to have a uniform system. That means every person voting in Georgia has to vote the same way on the same machines,
in
the same system.
Every single one of our many counties.
So there's a very broad discussion there. And so it's not as simple as just saying, oh, let's just get a new machine.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with AJC reporter Christina Torres. We're talking about the investigation into an alleged voter data breach at Kennesaw State's Election Center. Now, is this in any way, shape, or form, do we know, connected to, listeners may remember in 2015, the Secretary of State's office accidentally released the Social Security numbers and private information of millions of registered voters in Georgia. Is this related to that at all? Do we know?
Absolutely not, or at least there's no evidence it has anything to do with that. That appears to be a completely accidental mistake where they were making data disks available to groups that request them. The AJC got one, and it's public record.
Yeah.
You know, we get it. We have our own database where we can go back and look at voters and count voters. By all accounts, appears to be accidental that they filled in a few extra spaces on the data disk that had personal information,
including
Social Security numbers. When they realized this went out, they reached out to those organizations. There were 12 of them to get the disk back or have them destroyed. So that was strictly out of the Secretary of State's office. What we're talking about with the Election Center at Kennesaw State University is separate.
And it has also brought, we're talking about, it's brought up discussions on how we might record votes, but it has also brought back up for debate this very unusual relationship between Kennesaw State and the director of the center there, Merle King, and the state government, which is, as far as I can see, not replicated in any other state in the United States. It's unusual.
It is unique. It is unusual. They made that decision back around 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to stress, we've gone through three Secretary of State since then, Republican and Democrat. Mm-hmm. It's very much a nonpartisan idea of using a university, in this case, Kennesaw State University, as a way to help with what the state does to run elections. No, I'm not aware of any other state that does it that way either, but that's how they chose to do it.
Yeah. And although that's maybe one of the things that's up for discussion in the future, because one of the reasons for that whole thing was security, that they had different layers of security. And if there has been a data breach, if it turns out that there has been,
right,
it may call into question that security and whether it is as secure as they want.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, there are a lot of unknowns.
Yeah.
We assume they
more
came
unknowns
in,
than knowns.
And came in through the university's IT system, but we don't know for sure. I know the Secretary of State's office has been very clear in saying this is not any of their systems, which is why we assume it's the university system. But yeah, it does raise questions of then if there was a problem, if it's confirmed there was a problem, what happened and how did it happen? And do they want to keep that relationship then with a university that had that problem?
You just said we assume that it is the university system, meaning that we don't even know that from the FBI, that the breach they're investigating was at Kennesaw State?
Correct. The reason I say assume is that we don't know. The Secretary of State's office has said it's not their system. And
there's only one other system,
exactly,
that downloads voter data.
by deduction, we end up with the university. Again, you read the partial statement from the university itself of saying they're working with the FBI. They're referring questions to the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office as well. Again, we don't know for sure.
Although one of the things we don't know but can infer is the FBI says this is a criminal investigation, meaning that there in the end could be charges filed.
Again, I think that's a fair assumption.
We've been speaking with Christina Torres. She's a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You can continue to follow us, but also the AJC, as we try to answer some of the questions we don't know the answer to.
We will be following this up to and through what they find out.
Christina, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, the break room weighs coyote hunting and the best way to make a PBJ. First, though, we'll add two more tunes to our Essential Georgia playlist. This is On Second Thought.
I can do it in my sleep. I dream of you so often, it's like you never leave. But you've gone below the border with the nightmare in between. I'm sending the coyote to bring you back to me.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last week, On Second Thought was live from the Stopover Music Festival in Savannah. And there we met Savannah band Lulu the Giant. They performed some songs live on our show. And they just released their debut album, Kingdoms Fall, last month. We asked frontwoman Rachel Chayner to add a couple of tunes to our Georgia playlist. For this series, people choose two songs they think best represent our state. And the rules are really simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians can't nominate their own songs. We spoke to Rachel backstage at the Stopover Festival, and here are her picks. I woke up this
morning with my man. My name is Rachel Shaner. I'm the front woman for Lulu the Giant. And my pick for the Georgia playlist is, number one, the Freedom Singers. Hallelujah. It's one of their, like, main, you know, woke up this morning with freedom on my mind. It's a hallelujah. It's very Southern gospel, so. Back in the day, I loved them because they were huge in the civil rights movement, and they were able to make connections and bridges between their music and the political discourse that was going on. So they, and their sound is just impeccable. They've got those harmonies and were a big forefront in, yeah, the civil rights movement. So. Well, it's got that, it's got a super, you know, like I said, the Southern gospel feel, and having the lyrics also extend into just personal relationships. And, you know, it's never good to forget history, but it's great to be able to go back, hear that, and then see how they used music to influence their current state of affairs. And I think that music is and should always be a tool for that. Sound-wise, the vocals, the multiple harmonies, and some of the dissonance that's created, we try to incorporate vocal harmonies as much as possible along with the instrumentation, but they are an a cappella group, and so it's really nice to be able to hear their full sound without the instruments, and that's kind of how we develop our songs, is going from vocals, heavy vocals, and then incorporating the instruments to where it doesn't take away, but it's just enough to add. So I just love this song. I just love their song. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Georgia Flame, Louisiana Burn by Payne Bridges. And she is actually a local Savannah musician. Hero, a note asking for her hand. He didn't have a clue, he didn't make a plan. She fell so hard, she fell right in. Now they are apart. What's happening? The skies grew dark and the days lost light. The song is, you know, jumping bridges, obviously, between Louisiana and Georgia, but she's talking about this love, and it's so folk and fun that it really brings in a lot of the sound of Savannah. Louisiana's burn. What I really enjoy about her is just she's got a really unique voice, and she's got some really fun songs. But personally, that same air of like fun is in her songs. Even though it's folk and it can get really deep, she's able to keep just a joyful, a light around her, I guess. So it's always fun to hang out with her and then kind of get her insight on some things. So she's really cool. He can do no wrong. He only touches gold. The morning comes. She's still alone. She's searching for his arms. She's searching for a home. The skies grew dark and the days lost light. He stole her heart, took it across state lines, and now she waits and waits and prays for his return. Georgia flame, Louisiana burn. Georgia flame, Louisiana burn. It's just really fun. So, you know, going from from some heaviness, and then having you gotta add in some light songs. So that's why I really enjoy it. Yeah, I get to dance to it, especially with my bass. I play along.
State lines, Georgia's flight, Louisiana'sburg. Georgia's flight, Louisiana'sburg.
The sound of Georgia is definitely Southern gospel. That those roots are so deep and so encompassing. We have, you know, we're in the Bible Belt. We've also got our past with slavery, and so just these field songs, just to kind of go back and feel that heaviness and that truth and that and the way out. That is absolutely quintessential Southern sound.
That was Rachel Shaner, front woman for Savannah band Lulu the Giant. We spoke to her backstage at the Stopover Music Festival last week. They perform at Smith's Old Bar in the Atlanta Room on April 1st at 8 p.m. It has been a long week. We've talked about why Augusta was named one of the unhealthiest cities in the nation, and we looked at the adverse side effects of black beauty products. So as we do every Friday, we have gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, relax, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for The Break Room.
What happens when the last petal falls?
The Nastel remains a beast forever.
And we become antiques.
You have this guy, Lindsey Graham, a total lightweight. Here's a guy in the private sector, he couldn't get a job, believe me.
My apologies. Sorry.
Peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly.
Joining us in the break room, Natalie Pavelski is Vice President for Cater Communications. Kalina Baller is co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. Greg Williams, mortgage banker and host of the radio show Greg's List. And Stefan Turkheimer, lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
I'm excited to be here.
You are.
Oh my God, I can't even tell you.
Well,
I mean, part of that's the fact that it's Friday, but most of it is you.
I think it's because they promised green beer, and I don't see any.
No.
It was going to be green dry station.
Oh, it's going to be green coffee, my bad.
Right. Hopefully your coffee is not green. If so, do not drink it.
In a coffee room.
A beloved Disney classic makes another comeback.
Tell us oldest time.
Have you really read every one of these books?
Some of them are in Greek.
True as it can be.
That is a clip from the new Beauty and the Beast, starring Emma Watson. The film has stirred up some controversy. There's a short scene in the movie that shows two men kissing. The Malaysian government demanded that Disney cut that scene for the version that runs in their country. Disney denied that request, so the film will not play in Malaysia. And the question here is, should nations have some control over possibly offensive or objectionable content in movies? Should this lie only with the film studio, or should countries have a little bit of say-so?
I mean, okay, I'll go. Look. We're acting as if in the United States we don't have any control over the movies, but the reality is we pre-screen these things, we assign ratings,
yep.
We say people that are under 17 can't go to certain things, people that are under 13 can't go to others. So I think it's a little hypocritical to tell Malaysia that they can't sort of run a rule over our movies. That said, if you're going to object to part of Beauty and the Beast, why isn't it the sex with a buffalo part? I mean, I'm not.
That is something to think about.
The bestiality plot line should be.
It's in the name.
Heavily.
I mean,
right.
Come on! I was actually looking forward to taking my 4-year-old.
And
to this
and we can have different opinions on bestiality. It's okay.
Well,
this
is
a helpful
works,
space.
It works because
nowhere.
He eventually turns into a human.
Yeah. Well, as I pointed
eventually.
Out in the responses, here's the thing. I mean, anytime any entity tries to do censorship, it reminds me of Prohibition, the failed experiment here. You cannot censor everything, and the internet has made it almost impossible. So Malaysians that really want to see it, and by now they're going to be bi-curious, if you will, they're definitely going to want to
what?
See this deleted scene.
Did you just call all the people of Malaysia bi-curious?
I meant it as a pun.
Oh, I see. That pun went over my head.
I don't know what's happening. Okay, this is nothing new. we know that different countries, you know, refuse to show, you know,
they
certain movies at certain times.
Their culture. Yeah.
Right. And I don't see why, you know, this is even a controversy at this point. We know that there's some countries that are going to, you know, not show things or whatever. And like you said, Greg, if they want to see it, they'll find a way.
That's what I'm saying. It's a joke. They're bi-curious. They're curious about the gay scene. Well, never mind.
Either, not even this that. Is whatever it might be. You know, if they ban something for, you know, a woman wearing a skirt above her knee,
a
or
woman
something, whatever
showing
it might
an
be.
Ankle. I mean, they're
right. So I mean,
having sex
figure
with a horse,
or having sex with a horse right. That eventually turns
honestly,
human.
Honestly, I would like to move on because
this—that's a good idea.
This is really
listening.
Not going anywhere good. Okay, Pope Francis wants to consider allowing married men to become priests. Typically, in the Roman Catholic Church, as most of us know, celibacy is an absolute requirement in order if you're going to become ordained. The Pope's reasoning for this is he wants to build a crew of clergy in rural areas where there is currently a shortage of priests. So, good idea?
As a recovering Catholic, I say it is about time. We've got a serious priest shortage in this country. You know, the very first Pope, Peter, was married. They used to have married priests, and then some Pope decided that he could hack celibacy, and we went down that route. The only thing I'd say is while Pope Francis is at it, he needs to also end the sexism of a male-only priesthood, join the 21st century, and ordain women.
That's where I am. You know what I mean? I'm not a Catholic at all by any means. I have a few Catholic friends, and from what I understand, when they told me about this particular thing, how men are only priests, I said, this makes no sense to me. But then when I think about it, I was raised Christian, and in a lot of churches, Christian denominations, they discourage women from getting into the pulpit, even though they're completely ready. So I think that this is a completely backwards way of looking at monotheistic religions in today's age.
Somebody at a church I went to with my grandparents said, you can't have women as in the pulpit because he has to suffer through hearing them enough at home.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a great idea. It modernizes the church, and you know these the priests are looked at as advice givers, I guess, and the more real world experience they can have, if they're giving advice and taking confessionals, if they don't actually go through the experience themselves, I think it weakens their credibility.
I think that's exactly right. You know, I got married in the Methodist church, and so our premarital counseling was with a minister who was actually married and actually knew something about the institution.
Well, imagine what would happen if a married woman became a priest who also has real world experience.
There's one thing y'all are missing here, which is that the whole contract here is that that a married priest will have a relationship other than the one to his
God.
To his congregation and to God. And so you're essentially having a slight
splitting
conflict of
loyalties.
Interest there.
Yeah.
That's
but
the
no,
idea.
It's also a strength. It also means that you have a family on whom you can draw when you need it.
All right, let's move on to our next one. How badly does everybody here want to see Hamilton?
Oceans rise, empires fall. We have seen each other through it all. And when push comes to shove, I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. Da, 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 da.
If you have a disability, you might object to that show or any other Broadway show. In fact, a blind theater goer is suing the producers of Hamilton, saying they did not accommodate his impairment. He wants a headset with audio describing what he cannot see on stage. Now, Broadway has done a number of things to try to make its productions more accessible, but have they done enough? Should live theater be more accessible?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great idea. I think the private sector or a ancillary group could easily develop some kind of app for it to replace it in the meantime, because we're not going to have plays written in Braille anytime soon.
All right.
Right.
Like the complainants in this story, I haven't seen Hamilton. But.
Oh, God.
Is that too soon for this? Whatever. I'm continuing.
Yes, please do.
But there are actually a lot of plays that are already doing this. They have like a person that essentially voices the action on the stage and all that stuff. I think that is something that should occur.
Yeah.
I don't know that they necessarily need the mandate, and essentially when you sue someone, that's what you're asking a court to do. But at the same time, I do think this is something whose time has come.
Yeah, I mean, as much money as they're paying for these tickets, I mean, they better offer something for everybody, you know?
Well, it's a musical, really, but again, I think that, you know, wherever necessity is the mother of all inventions, correct? So, you know, what if a entrepreneur came up with some kind of app that was able to take care of this problem instead of having to go through a government mandate. That
sure.
would be my argument.
And the other option is you could just read my Facebook feed, because half the time it's just things about Hamilton.
Yes, it's constantly Hamilton.
That's right.
Yes. I should mention that Sam Burnham has gone onto Twitter and said, putting Stefan Turkheimer and Greg Williams on the air together, oh boy. And you're aww. Right, Sam, as we've seen already. This is actually a sequel.
Me and Stefan were on about a month ago, so this is the sequel to that great story. This is like Empire Strikes Back. It's going to be better than the first.
Natalie, did you want to say something about Hamilton?
You know, to the extent this can be done, why not do it? It sounds like you can add it to the already computerized light and sound cues for not a whole lot of money. And if you're making as much money as the producers of Hamilton, you know, let's accommodate everybody.
It is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. As you know, you can always weigh in with your opinion as well. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us. Coming up, we'll talk about the right way to make a PB&J. Plus, Snoop Dogg has a controversial new music video out. Go figure. That's next from On Second Thought.
Of the sea, back to the block, Snoop Doggy Dogg, Funky get the doc. Went solo on that ass, but it's still the same. Long Beach is the spot where I serve my cane. Follow me, but you bet not slip, cause 9 Triz ain't the years there for me to quiz out my grip. So I ain't holding nothing back.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We are having coffee and conversation in the break room. My guest today, Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, Stefan Turkheimer of Georgia Poll, Kalina Bowler of the Real Snobs podcast, and Greg Williams of the radio show Greg's List. And we want to say thank you to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we drink. It is delicious. They're online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, last month something very troubling happened in Dahlonega, Georgia. In the main square, a large sign on a building went up that read Historic Ku Klux Klan Meeting Hall. After a lot of protests, the sign was taken down, but a number of local residents actually objected to the removal of the sign. They said that was a violation of free speech. So, two questions. A, is it? Should the sign have stayed up? And B, would you be shocked to see something like that go up in your own town?
If a sign like that went up in Midtown Atlanta, oh yeah, I'd be shocked. And let's hope we never allow ourselves to stop being shocked by signs like that. Hateful displays like that in this day and age?
Yeah.
And, you know, the unfortunate thing is signs like that have gone up in Midtown, and I've actually seen them within the last year, and it's really, really sad. I remember seeing flyers go up all around Cabbage Town, for instance, one time, and the neighbors were, of course, you know, outraged, and they were like, what is going on? And of course they were taken down. Yeah, free speech is great. You know, you actually absolutely have the right to, you know, say what you mean, but you cannot tell and you cannot say what the reaction will be. So of course this reaction seems right in line with what happened, but I'm not shocked about it. Of course if something like that would go up.
I was about to say, nothing shocks me anymore. So,
well, wait a minute. Isn't there a danger though? If we stop being shocked about things like this, we're normalized.
Well, we're being desensitized to it. So things like this, unfortunately occur so often and we have so much, daily interaction with social media where we just glance through, we can scroll through something on Twitter where all the mean people live or the or Facebook or anything, and you just see things that are just so outlandish that it really has desensitized me personally. So I don't get shocked by it. Now, are there consequences for your free speech that doesn't jive with mainstream American thought? Absolutely. It's one of those things where somebody that works for a corporation, if they post something, a racist rant on Twitter and they get fired for it, of course they had the right to say it. The company also had the right to fire them for embarrassing the company.
But did the public have a right to demand the removal of a sign?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, the public outcry has made a lot of things better in society. It's always the public. These boycotts have had some effect from both conservatives and liberals, and that's really a public outcry, isn't it?
Stefan, you're the lawyer here.
I know. That is absolutely true. Well, look, yeah, I mean, the First Amendment does protect speech, and obviously you can't have a signed ordinance that says, okay, no hateful speech, but just cool speech. That's not something that's going to work. But you're right. I mean, basically the public fought back on this and had it removed. And there's a lot of complicated stuff going on there. But what the magic of it is that there are people that are so fired up about this that they're willing to go outside and protest, both for and against, and that we can have these kind of public debates because we're in a society that allows it. So, I mean, the same society that allows the free speech of the KKK sign allows the protest against it. And that's those forces, countervailing forces, will decide what the society
yep.
is.
Right. Agree 100%.
If you want to weigh in on this, tell us if you think the sign should have stayed up and whether you'd be shocked. You know how to reach us. Tweet us at OST Talk. Sam Burnham again says, weighs in again. He says there needs to be a balance between free speech and propriety, which sounds like you guys all agree with. Okay, so let's test that a little further. Rapper Snoop Dogg is at the center of controversy yet again. This time he's under fire for his new music video. In it, he stages a mock assassination of a clown that looks like Donald Trump. Here's a clip. Okay, that is from the song Lavender. Not much clues there as to what's going on. But in fact, he shoots this little gun at a fictional Trump and a little cartoon bang sign flops out of the front of the gun. Trump, not happy with that. He tweeted, quote, "Can you imagine what the outcry would be if Snoop Dogg, failing career and all, had aimed and fired the gun at President Obama? Jail time," end quote. Even to Florida, Senator Marco Rubio called the video dangerous. You're shaking your head already, Natalie.
Yeah, because President Obama would not have even deigned to respond to a silly video like this. Look, this is 4.5 minutes of my life I'm never going to get back. It's full of...
of watching the video.
Yeah. It's 4-syllable words. It's 4-letter words. It's the N-word. It's
Snoop.
Sloppy.
It's Snoop.
Right.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he points this flag gun at somebody who's supposed to be sort of a Trump stand-in. This is protected artistic speech. It is protected political speech. And I really wish, you know, the president wouldn't waste his time on it. And secondly, if he's going to waste his time on it, there are other amendments than the Second Amendment. We have a First Amendment. Nobody gets thrown in jail for this kind of thing.
Right. Well, and it's like a shooting in effigy, if you will, right? I mean, I've seen conservatives say, well, if this had been done against Obama, imagine the outrage. And I haven't seen it. I didn't realize it was such a kind of a
effigies
child,
like that have been put up against Obama.
Such a childish.
On several occasions.
And such a childish type video. And I had just been talking about how wonderful Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre's album was back in the early 90s.
So yeah.
Well, I may have to remove that from the record.
What's amazing is that Snoop shoots a clown and everyone already realizes it's Trump. Like, surprising anyone.
It was the hair. Come
but
on.
I will take issue with Marco Rubio's statement. I think he was trying to compare the video in a positive sense to Michael Jackson's Dangerous video.
Oh,
I think
no.
that's what
come
he's attempting
on.
To do. Its context is important here. But yeah,
hilarious.
I mean, look, everyone else sort of gets upset when Donald Trump wastes his time complaining about Snoop, but I'm thrilled that's how he's using his time. Look at how he spends the rest of his time when he's concentrating on his job. I would hope that Donald Trump spends the next... until impeachment or the next remainder of the 4 years, just commenting on music videos. I think we'd all be happier if that's what he did.
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Wouldn't it be great?
That's why we were happy when Obama was playing golf. That meant he wasn't taking away liberties for 8 years.
We can all agree.
Okay, here we go.
All right, so here is one that is way less controversial than any of that. March 31st is Peanut Butter and Jelly Day. Okay, this is really serious business in Georgia, as we know. We are Peanut Central. We are Goober Pea Heaven. This is the peanut state.
Yes.
That was nice.
So,
what'd you call me?
here's the question. Is there a right way to make a PB&J? Have you ever had a bad PB&J?
No.
Yes.
You can't have too much jelly on it, I guess. Is that possible?
Oh, my God. Kalina is like shocked to her core.
The
jelly to peanut butter ratio, it has to have more peanut butter than jelly.
The thing is, it's like, I don't know if you've ever fed a dog peanut butter. But basically, if you have too much
I'm really
peanut
not
butter,
into that stuff.
Well,
but,
I mean.
Oh my that's how God. You give them their pills.
This is a morning show.
I know. This is a morning show.
We start with Beauty and the Beast. So.
All right. Let's dial it back.
Oh, sorry, my mistake.
To PG-13.
No, I agree. The ratio is keenly important here, and also is the bread, and then we can get into how it's made. A fried PB&J, grilled PB&Js are fantastic.
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 I'm glad you mentioned bread, because I think people forget that you need to have the right kind of bread for PB&J.
And so what's the right kind?
Gluten-free wheat bread is not the right bread.
You're correct in that. It needs to be, you know, the white bread in the long, you know, yellow bag
colonial
with the girl on it.
Colonial.
Right. Yeah, it needs to be that sort of bread.
Wonder
very
bread.
Soft, very fluffy. And it needs to be soft yet dry. Sometimes when I would get my PB&Js in my lunchbox, the condensation would get in there.
Somebody's getting fired for that.
And I'm triggered. I hate that word, but I'm triggered right now. I feel bad. I don't like this.
Natalie? Well, I think there's one wrong way to make a PB&J, and we can all agree on this, and that is if you put down the bread and put the jelly on first. Because then if you put the peanut butter down, you put the bread,
it will not spread. Hold on, now I'm confused. You don't put the peanut butter on one of the slices and
that's
the jelly on the other and
that's
then
what I'm,
smack them together?
That's another acceptable technique, if you're really into the fillings, is to put peanut butter on both sides and jelly on both sides.
Oh.
But then it's like a double-decker.
And then it's a double-decker
that's
PBJ.
That's like a double meat sandwich at
you
Subway.
You have blown Stefan Turkheimer's mind.
I don't even know what utensils you use for that. That's amazing.
And I like after all that, we have recipes to fry said sandwich. Mm-hmm. I mean, we fry Twinkies,
well, I
we
like
have fried
a grilled
Oreos
PBJ.
Here.
I
mean, we
grilled
fry
PBJ is no joke.
Fried green tomatoes.
Are you serious?
So vegetables
you're
unhealthy
right
in the South. That's
you can
what
also
I like
make,
the South.
Well, number one, I come from California, so I use whole wheat sprouted bread for my PBJs. Sorry.
God bless you.
Fail. Sorry.
Hashtag fail.
And her peanut butter is actually tahini.
No.
Almond butter.
But when I make grilled PBJs,
responsibly raised peanuts.
I put only peanut butter on the sandwich. I grill it like a grilled cheese, and then I dip it in the jam.
Oh, my God.
Oh. How highfalutin
okay,
is that?
Okay, you've blown my mind.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Try
on some Grey Poupon.
Okay, if
got
you are just
chance.
Joining us, we want to hear your PB&J recipes. We are hanging out in the break room and with Natalie Pavelski, Greg Williams, Stefan Turkheimer, and Kalina Baller. Okay, let's talk about animals. When it comes to coyotes, you either love them or hate them, right? That debate is currently playing out in Georgia. Our state wildlife service is encouraging hunters to kill coyotes in and around Atlanta. The Georgia Department of Natural Resources says, quote, coyote predation is scientifically shown to negatively impact wildlife populations, kill livestock, kill domestic pets, and contribute to undesired human-coyote interactions, end quote. Many wildlife and animal activists say it's inhumane and possibly dangerous if it's too close to homes. So what do you think? Open season against coyotes?
Well,
yeah,
I definitely prefer cougars at Johnny's Hideaway to coyotes. But
I'm sick.
As
it's a wrap, guys. Thank you for having me on.
As I pointed out, coyotes are dangerous to pets and children and actually humans. So I do think that the coyote awareness campaign is a good one, although everybody that has a gun is not actually adept at shooting guns. So I do see the danger in suburban people that shoot their gun once every 6 months that are now going to go shoot Wile E. Coyote in the backyard.
And it's not even suburbia. In Atlanta, you know, in Midtown, we have two coyotes in
the
neighborhoods.
Oh, my gosh.
And in Piedmont Park. So I'm picturing I'm picturing Elmer Fudd in Piedmont Park. Okay. Now, it's different in rural Georgia. I get that. But in urban areas, this is a problem.
But there needs to be a population control. Absolutely. We kill millions of bugs every year. Pest control is huge. So I think of this as an extension of pest control in
my
home.
The thing with it is, according to Georgia law, if you take a coyote out of Piedmont Park, you have to put it down. You're not allowed to relocate it. Mm. So
or adopt it.
And
this is
the beast. We're coming back.
Just let me inject a little bit of fact in here, which is that almost no humans are attacked by coyotes ever.
But
and
apparently, a lot
because
of coyotes,
we have guns. You
but
shoot
apparently,
one coyote,
a lot of coyotes are attacked by humans.
Yes.
Ah.
And they're almost coyote attacks are extremely rare, and when they occur, they're almost never serious.
Well, I use guns on spiders and also coyotes.
I say the same thing about ants, spiders, and cockroaches. You know, people are rarely attacked by them, but we spend millions of dollars
it's
controlling them.
The war on insects.
All right, okay,
this is a terrible
idea.
No one can tell the difference between a coyote and a dog at night. They're going to shoot a bunch of people's animals, maybe some kids.
Yeah, you're
it's
right
a bad
about
idea.
That.
Okay, let's move on to something more adorable. Everybody probably has already seen that video that went viral last week.
Shifting sands in the region. Do you think relations with the North may change?
I would be surprised if they do. The, pardon me. jeez.
Okay. That is a Robert Kelly, an expert on Korea, doing an interview with the BBC. It was live from his home office via Skype. And as we most of us know, his very young and totally adorable kids burst through the door with a lot of swagger, quickly followed by their anxious mother trying to drag them out of the room. All right, we can all laugh, but there actually are a ton of parents out there who work from home. So the question is, how do you stop this from happening? What's your strategies to prevent kids and pets?
Oh, you can try, but nothing is 100%. I have had my daughter join vocally in conference calls in my home office. I even had our basset hound join in a call to the British embassy up in Washington.
Nice.
Yeah, we're talking to the embassy and you hear this, oh.
Nice.
That's how they view all Americans. They all think we like live with the livestock and whatever. They probably were just like normal American.
She's, I don't know why they have that accent. Shooting our coyotes on a Monday morning.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I live in a loft, so this is even harder for me because I don't have doors or walls. So I just keep moving constantly and try and stay ahead of whatever beasts are in my house. I don't have children, but the dog is faster than the children anyway, so it's not really that helpful.
Yeah, I have a dog as well. And even though I have yet to do a video conference for something like this, I do a lot of Skype calls, so I just keep my finger on the mute button constantly, just in case I need to quickly, you know, hit that button.
Well, I have two dogs, and they tend to love barking when I do get on the phone, because apparently I'm not paying them attention, and, you know, when you're taking a mortgage application or trying to have a serious conversation, they're like, what's that noise? I was like, I don't know, it's a coyote or something. But
so the consensus problem is dogs and coyotes.
Yeah.
Right.
The children, though, that video is awesome when the toddler, the one that was still in the stroller, just burst in, just kind of like it had been like rolling downhill.
The baby
walker. Yeah, that was awesome. Like, how did she get the momentum to just burst in the room?
Yeah. I think we can, goes without saying, are awesome. Okay. All right. One last thing, and we have just a few minutes to talk about it. But yet again, Donald Trump and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham are feuding. This time, Graham wants information about Trump's possible connections to Russia.
I've seen no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, but the longer it takes to answer my letter, the more concerned and suspicious I'm beginning to be.
Graham is also concerned about the truth behind Trump's claim that President Obama wiretapped his phone. But answers to those questions will come, if they do, at federal expense. So the question is, do we support the use of taxpayer money to investigate these things?
Sure. I mean, as George W. Bush said, quote, we need all the answers concerning possible Russian efforts to intervene in the 2016 presidential election. I think we need to know what happened here. And if it takes taxpayer money to figure it out, I'm all for it.
We should absolutely use taxpayer resources to investigate the president. President Obama has a track record that needs to be researched.
No, the minute that we let insane, unhinged tweets decide what congressional investigations happen is a sad moment.
Well, normally I was not a big fan of Lindsey Graham. I mean, when he was running for president, Skim Milk was doing better in the poll numbers than him.
Oh,
but he got us into, after the inauguration in D.C., he snuck us in to watch the confirmation of General Mattis. And I can't say anything negative about Lindsey Graham anymore.
And this is a bipartisan effort, too. He's teaming up with the head Democrat on his subcommittee to do this.
It's true. And I think this is absolutely what they need to be doing. And taxpayer money is clearly the correct way. In fact, when I wrote my check to the IRS recently, I actually put on the memo line. For Lindsey Graham.
I don't mind my own taxpayer dollars going. I know there's going to be a lot of people to say, oh, I don't want my taxpayers going. I get it. But I absolutely want this investigated.
Mine went to Rand Paul, so...
There you go.
Well, all right. We are out of time in the break room. I want to say thank you to all my guests. Greg Williams, mortgage banker, host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. Natalie Pavelski is vice president for Cato Communications. Stefan Turkheimer is a lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. And Kalina Bowler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And hi to my parents in East Cobb. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you for giving me a heart attack several times this morning as I, you know, feared for an appearance by the FCC.
But, you're welcome.
But I want to welcome, as always, comments from our listeners. We have a ton of tweets about things we were discussing today. Bring them on. We want to hear them. You can find us at OST Talk on Twitter or call 404-500-9457. I am on Twitter at Celeste Headley. For today and the week, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.